Have you ever really stopped to think about the incredible hidden processes that power every single thing you do?
It's pretty amazing stuff.
Right. From just thinking to running a race. It all comes down to how our bodies, well, really, all life gets energy from the food we eat.
It's like this constant microscopic ballet happening inside us.
Exactly. And today, we're diving deep into that world, looking at what scientists call the catabolism of fuels.
Yeah, and our guide for this is some really insightful material from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. His lectures break this down so clearly, step by step. It's complex, but he makes it accessible.
So our mission, really, is to untangle these, you know, intricate energy pathways. We want to highlight the surprising bits and the core ideas Dr. Hoffman lays out.
Think of it as your fast track to understanding cellular fuel.
Okay, so where do we start? Dr. Hoffman often kicks things off with a big picture idea, doesn't he? Comparing energy and materials in an ecosystem.
That's right. He contrasts energy flow with material recycling. Energy, mostly starting from sunlight, it flows through the system.
Through, meaning it doesn't stick around.
Pretty much. It comes in, gets transformed, passed along, but ultimately it leaves, mostly as heat. It's more of a one-way street.
Ah, okay. But materials are different.
Totally different. Matter, the actual atoms and molecules, gets recycled within the ecosystem. It changes form, moves between organisms, but it largely stays put. It's a closed loop, more or less.
Yeah, it's a really fundamental distinction.
It is. And you see it clearly with producers and consumers.
Yeah.
Producers think plants, algae, they're amazing. They make their own food, usually using photosynthesis.
And we're the consumers. We rely on them or on other consumers for those essential organic compounds.
Completely. And Dr. Hoffman really emphasizes this point about carbon fixation. Producers grab inorganic carbon, like CO2 from the air.
The stuff we breathe out.
Exactly. And they fix it. They incorporate it into organic molecules, the carbon skeletons that build everything else. We consumers simply can't do that.
We're totally dependent on them for those basic building blocks.
Absolutely dependent. Which underscores how interconnected everything is. And this leads right into what Dr. Hoffman calls the reciprocal relationship.
Between photosynthesis and what we're focusing on today, the complete oxidation of fuel.
Yeah, they essentially undo each other. Photosynthesis uses CO2 and water, makes organic stuff and oxygen.
And then our cells take those organic molecules, use oxygen, and what comes out?
CO2 and water again. It's this beautiful mirrored cycle.
And Dr. Hoffman has this great line about the CO2 we exhale.
Oh, yeah. That it's simply what's left over of the food that you ate, completely dismantled.
It's not just waste. It's recycled material, ready to go back into the cycle.
Precisely. An elegant system.
Okay. So let's get down to the nitty gritty. How does this energy transfer actually happen inside the cell? Dr. Hoffman says it's all about electrons, right? Redox reactions.
Exactly. Redox, it stands for reduction oxidation. And the terms can be a bit counterintuitive at first.
Okay.
Reduction is the gain of electrons.
Wait, reduction means gain. Usually reduction means less of something.
I know. But think about charge. Electrons are negative. So if you gain electrons, your overall charge is reduced.
Okay, that makes sense. So oxidation must be.
The loss of electrons.
Got it. Gain is reduction, loss is oxidation.
And the crucial thing, Dr. Hoffman stresses, they always happen together. You can't have one without the other. If something loses an electron.
And something else has to gain it. A perfect pairing.
Always. So when we talk about getting energy from our food, from our fuels, we are fundamentally oxidizing them.
We're taking electrons away from the fuel molecules.
That's how we tap into their stored energy.
And Dr. Hoffman explains why things like fats, those hydrocarbons, are such good fuels because of this.
Right. In hydrocarbons, the electrons in the carbon-hydrogen bonds are shared pretty equally. They're at a relatively higher energy level.
Okay.
When we break those down and rearrange things, especially involving oxygen, which is very greedy for electrons.
Electronegative is the term.
Highly electronegative, yes. The electrons move closer to oxygen to a lower energy level, a more stable state. And that difference in energy is released.
Like rolling downhill.
That's a great analogy. The energy gets released as the electrons roll downhill towards oxygen.
So what's the main fuel our cells prefer?
Dr. Hoffman identifies glucose, C6H12O6, a simple carbohydrate, as the master fuel for pretty much all cells.
The go-to energy source. But if it has all this energy, why don't cells just, you know, burn it all at once, like lighting a match to it seems faster.
But Dr. Hoffman explains that would be disastrous. It would be, quote, a hell of a lot of energy all at once as heat and light.
Which would kill the cell.
instantly. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't be able to capture the energy usefully anyway. It would just dissipate.
So control is key, not speed.
Exactly. Cells use what Dr. Hoffman calls a stepwise combustion, more like a controlled burn.
He uses a hydroelectric plant analogy too, right? Releasing energy bit by bit.
Yeah, releasing energy a little bit at a time through a whole series of chemical reactions. This allows the cell to capture that released energy.
And store it as ATP.
ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That's the cell's universal energy currency. It's like the dollar bill of the cell.
So same total energy released eventually, but doing it in steps lets us actually pocket some of it as ATP.
Precisely. The overall change in energy, the delta G, is the same, but the step-by-step process makes capture possible. You always lose some as heat. That's just thermodynamics.
Second law. Can't avoid it.
Can't avoid it, but you maximize the useful energy captured as ATP.
Okay, so how do these steps actually work? You mentioned oxidizing the fuel, taking electrons. Is it about taking hydrogens?
That's a key part of it. Dr. Hoffman talks about picking off the hydrogens, which is dehydrogenation. Since a hydrogen atom is basically a proton and an electron, removing hydrogens is a major way to remove electrons, hence oxidation.
And special enzymes do this.
Yes, dehydrogenase enzymes. They catalyze these reactions, but they need help. They need Dr. Hoffman's taxis.
Taxis, like picking things up and dropping them off.
Exactly. These are coenzymes. The big ones are NAD plus nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide and FAD flavin adenine adenine dinucleotide.
NAD plus and FAD. Got it.
They act like electron carriers. They pick up electrons, and often protons, the hydrogen part, from the fuel as it's being oxidized.
So when they pick up the electrons, they become charged up, higher energy.
Exactly. They become reduced. NAD plus picks up two electrons and one proton effectively, becoming NADH plus a spare proton, H plus. FAD picks up two full hydrogen atoms, becoming FADH2. These reduced forms, NADH and FADH2, are carrying the energy extracted from the fuel.
They're the full taxis.
Full taxis, holding valuable cargo. Then they travel to another part of the process to drop off that energy, returning to their oxidized forms, NAD plus and FAD, the empty taxis, ready for another pickup. Dr. Hoffman calls them very valuable stuff.
Okay, let's follow the journey then. Glucose breakdown. Step one.
Step one is glycolysis. And Dr. Hoffman emphasizes this happens out in the main fluid part of the cell, the cytosol, not inside any specific compartment yet.
Glycolysis. Sugar splitting.
Literally. It's a sequence of 10 reactions. You start with one molecule of glucose, which has 6 carbons.
And you split it.
Into 2 molecules of pyruvate. Each pyruvate has 3 carbons.
Okay, 6 becomes 2 3s. Does it make energy?
It does, but it's a bit tricky. There's an energy investment phase first. You actually have to spend 2 ATPs to get the process going.
Got to spend money to make money, huh?
Kind of. But then comes the energy payoff phase, where you generate 4 ATPs.
So a net gain of 2 ATP per glucose.
Net gain of 2 ATP. And importantly, you also produce 2 NADH molecules, 2 of those full energy taxis.
How is the ATP made here? Is it that complex spinning thing yet?
Not yet. This is called substrate-level phosphorylation. It's more direct. A high-energy molecule in the pathway literally transfers its phosphate group directly onto ADP to make ATP. Simple handoff.
Okay, so glycolysis gives us 2 pyruvate, 2 net ATP, and 2 NADH. Is the pyruvate spent fuel now?
Not completely. As Dr. Hoffman points out, there's still a lot of energy locked up in pyruvate. It's just the first stage.
Which leads us to stage 2.
Cellular respiration. And this, in our cells, eukaryotic cells, happens inside the mitochondrion. The powerhouse.
Right. So pyruvate gets shipped into the mitochondria.
Exactly. It's transported inside. And the first thing that happens there is a little step called oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate.
Okay. Breaking that down. Oxidative means losing electrons. Decarboxylation means losing a carbon.
You got it. The 3-carbon pyruvate loses 1 carbon atom, which leaves as CO2. That CO2, Dr. Hoffman notes, is completely spent fuel. No more energy there.
And since it's oxidative,
energy is extracted. Specifically, 1 NADH is produced for each pyruvate. Since we got 2 pyruvates from glucose, that's another 2 NADH overall.
What's left of the pyruvate, then?
It becomes a 2-carbon molecule called an acetyl group. This acetyl group immediately attaches to another coenzyme, coenzyme A, forming acetyl coenzyme A.
Another taxi.
Sort of, but this one carries the fuel fragment, the acetyl group, into the next major stage.
Which is?
The citric acid cycle. You might also know it as the TCA cycle, or the Krebs cycle.
Right, heard of that one. Where does this happen?
This happens deeper inside the mitochondrion, in the mitochondrial matrix, the inner fluid-filled space.
And what does acetyl-CoA do there?
It delivers that 2-carbon acetyl group. The cycle starts when the acetyl group combines with a 4-carbon molecule that's already there, oxaloacetate, forming a 6-carbon molecule, citrate. That's why it's called the citric acid cycle.
And then it goes around in a circle, not a straight line like glycolysis.
Exactly. It's a cycle. The main goal here, Dr. Hoffman stresses, is to complete the oxidation of the fuel.
Meaning strip off all the remaining useful bits.
Pretty much. Those last 2 carbons from the acetyl group get released as CO2 during the cycle. So for every glucose molecule that started, all 6 carbons have now been released as CO2 by the end of this cycle.
Wow. Okay. So what's the energy payoff from this cycle? More ATP.
You get a little bit of ATP directly, again, via substrate-level phosphorylation. But the major payoff from the citric acid cycle is capturing more high-energy electrons. It generates a lot more NADH and also FADH2, that other electron taxi we mentioned.
So by the end of the Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle.
Yeah.
The original glucose is gone, turned into CO2. And most of its energy is now sitting in these NADH and FADH2 molecules.
That's the perfect summary. Dr. Hoffman says no more useful fuel is left, only CO2. The energy is temporarily stored in those reduced coenzymes.
Which brings us to the grand finale, I assume, where the big ATP payoff happens.
Absolutely. This is oxidative phosphorylation, the main event. Dr. Hoffman calls it the big payoff.
Where does this magic happen?
This happens in and across the inner mitochondrial membrane. That membrane is highly folded, creating lots of surface area.
Okay, oxidative phosphorylation. 2 parts to that name.
Right. First part involves the electron transport chain, the ETC.
The bucket brigade analogy from Dr. Hoffman.
That's the one. NADH and FADH2 arrive at this chain of protein complexes embedded in the inner membrane. They dump their high-energy electrons onto the first complex.
And the electrons get passed down the chain.
Like a bucket brigade, yes. From one protein complex to the next. And crucially, each step down the chain is to a slightly lower energy level.
Releasing energy as they go.
Exactly. And what does the cell do with that released energy? It uses it to pump protons, hydrogen ions, H+ from the matrix out into the space between the inner and outer membranes, the intermembrane space.
Pumping them uphill, creating a difference in concentration.
Precisely. It creates a steep proton gradient. And Dr. Hoffman emphasizes any gradient like that is a form of stored energy, like water behind a dam.
Okay, this sounds important. Now, what about oxygen? You mentioned earlier electrons roll downhill towards oxygen.
Yes. Here's where it gets critical. Dr. Hoffman poses the question, why do we need oxygen? This is the answer.
At the end of the line for the electrons.
It is the final electron acceptor. After the electrons have gone down the whole chain, releasing their energy, they have to go somewhere. Oxygen, being highly electronegative, gladly takes those electrons.
What if there's no oxygen?
Then the electrons have nowhere to go. The whole chain backs up, like a traffic jam. NADH and FADH2 can't unload their electrons, they stay full. And the whole ATP production via this route grinds to a halt.
Wow. So oxygen keeps the chain moving by taking the spent electrons. And what does it become?
It combines those electrons with protons from the surrounding solution to form water, H2O. That's where the water byproduct comes from.
Okay, so that's the oxidative part involving oxygen and electron transport. What about the phosphorylation part, making ATP?
That comes next. It's called chemiosmosis. We've built up this proton gradient, lots of protons crammed into the intermembrane space. They want to flow back into the matrix, down their concentration gradient.
Like water wanting to flow through the dam.
Perfect. But they can't just pass through the membrane directly. They have to flow through a specific channel.
And that channel is special.
Very special. It's an enzyme complex called ATP synthase. It acts like both a channel and a turbine.
A turbine. It spins.
It literally spins. As the protons rush back through ATP synthase into the matrix, the flow causes part of the enzyme to rotate.
Like a water wheel.
Exactly like a water wheel. And this rotation provides the mechanical energy to stick a phosphate group onto ADP, creating ATP.
That's amazing. So the energy from the electron flow was stored in the proton gradient, and the flow of protons back through ATP synthase powers the ATP making.
That's oxidative phosphorylation. And this is where the vast majority, Dr. Hoffman says, more than 90% of the ATP from oxidizing glucose is actually made. It's incredibly efficient.
Mind-bogglingly complex and efficient.
Yeah.
But what if oxygen isn't available? Like you're sprinting flat out.
Ah, yes. Dr. Hoffman calls this the fork in the road. If there's no oxygen, oxidative phosphorylation stops. The electron transport chain jams up.
Which means NADH and FADH2 can't drop off their electrons. They stay reduced.
Correct. And this creates a secondary problem. Remember glycolysis, that very first step?
Yeah, made a little ATP and some NADH.
It needs NAD plus DOT, the oxidized form, to accept electrons during one of its steps. If all the NAD plus is stuck as NADH because the ETC is blocked,
then glycolysis stops too.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So no ATP production at all?
Potentially, yes. Which is why cells evolved a backup plan, fermentation.
Okay, what's the main goal of fermentation? Is it to make ATP?
Surprisingly, no. Dr. Hoffman clarifies that fermentation itself does not produce ATP. Its sole purpose is to solve the NAD plus problem.
To regenerate NAD plus from NADH?
Exactly. It takes the pyruvate from glycolysis and uses it, along with the excess NADH, in reactions that ultimately oxidize the NADH back into NAD plus form.
Glycolysis can keep going.
So glycolysis can keep churning out its small net yield of 2 ATP per glucose. It allows the cell to survive anaerobically without oxygen, at least for a while.
What kinds of fermentation does Dr. Hoffman mention?
He covers two main types relevant to us. Alcohol fermentation, which things like yeast do. Pyruvate gets converted ultimately to ethanol, and CO2 is released. That's the bubbles in beer and bread. Mm-hmm. And in the process, NADH becomes NAD plus N.
And the other one happens in us.
Lactic acid fermentation. This happens in our muscle cells during intense bursts of activity when oxygen delivery can't keep up. Pyruvate is converted directly into lactic acid or lactate.
And this also regenerates NAD plus AP.
Yes. Same principle. NADH is oxidized back to NAD plus AT, allowing glycolysis to continue. No CO2 is produced in this type, though.
Is that lactic acid what makes muscles sore or tired?
It contributes to muscle fatigue, yes. Dr. Hoffman notes the trade-off. You get survival ATP, but way less than with oxygen, and you get this lactic acid buildup. He also mentions that training improves metabolic scope, meaning your body gets better at delivering oxygen, delaying the need for fermentation.
So it's a necessary backup, but not the preferred route.
Definitely not. The ATP yield is tiny compared to cellular respiration.
Now, we've talked almost entirely about glucose, but we eat fats and proteins too. How do they fit in?
Great question. Dr. Hoffman explains that the pathway for glucose oxidation we've discussed is really the central pathway. Other fuels can plug into it.
So we don't need separate machinery for everything.
Nope. Fats are broken down into glycerol and fatty acids, proteins into amino acids, other sugars into glucose or similar simple sugars. These smaller components can then enter the glycolysis or citric acid cycle pathways at various points.
They kind of jump in partway through.
Exactly. Fatty acids, for example, are broken down into acetyl-CoA, which goes straight into the citric acid cycle. They skip glycolysis entirely. It's very flexible.
What about proteins? Dr. Hoffman mentioned a challenge there.
Right. While amino acids can be used for fuel, the cell prefers to recycle them to build new proteins. If they are used for energy, the amino group, MASH NH2, has to be removed first.
Why is that?
Because it forms ammonia, NH3, which is toxic. So the liver converts this ammonia into a much less toxic compound called urea.
Which we then excrete in urine.
Correct. And Dr. Hoffman notes this ties into issues like gout if protein breakdown is excessive, leading to urea-related crystal buildup.
Okay, one last big piece. With all these steps and cycles, how does the cell control it all? It can't just be running full blast all the time, right?
Absolutely not. That would be incredibly wasteful. Dr. Hoffman explains the cell uses sophisticated feedback mechanisms.
Like signals telling the pathway to speed up or slow down.
Precisely. There are key enzymes, particularly one in glycolysis called phosphofructokinase, that act as major control points or throttles.
And what signals control them?
It's based on the cell's energy status. High levels of ATP, the final product, act as an inhibitor. If the cell has plenty of energy,
tells the pathway, whoa, slow down, we're good.
Exactly. Citrate, an early product of the citric acid cycle, also acts as an inhibitor if it starts to build up. It signals that the downstream processes are keeping up. These are like red arrows slowing things down.
What about speeding things up? Green arrows.
The main activator is AMP adenosine monophosphate. Dr. Hoffman has a great analogy for this. Seeing AMP is like using a debit card when you have a very low balance.
It means ATP has been used up extensively, signaling an energy crisis.
Right. High AMP is a potent signal that the cell desperately needs more ATP. So AMP activates enzymes like phosphofructokinase, massively ramping up glucose breakdown.
So it's this constant adjustment, matching energy production to the actual demand.
It's an incredibly elegant feedback system, precise control.
Wow. So when you step back and look at everything Dr. Hoffman lays out, It's just astounding, isn't it? These elegant interconnected processes happening constantly inside every single cell just to keep us alive.
It really is. From that big picture energy flow and ecosystems, right down to the dance of electrons and protons in our mitochondria, it's biological machinery at its finest.
The next time you breathe out, just think
that
CO2 isn't just, you know, waste gas. Dr. Hoffman reminds us it's literally the remnants of the food you ate, recycled back into the big cycle of life.
And every breath in isn't just air. It's providing that crucial oxygen, the final electron acceptor that makes the whole high-efficiency energy release possible.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other kinds of spent fuels in our own lives, maybe metaphorical ones, could hold surprising stories of transformation and potential for recycling? Something to think about.